This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I just kept gravitating back to the acoustic piano. I think it's one of the most amazing pieces of work that mankind has ever come up with. And so I usually stay with the vintage instruments, and I think maybe there is a connection organically to nature and the outdoors and to my interest in forests and forestry.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we dip into the archives to reconnect with three timeless essentials: the sun, the trees, and music. First, I speak with Adam Browning, the executive director of Vote Solar, a nonprofit organization that advocates for solar power adoption. We discuss the lessons we can learn from success stories like the German solar industry and look at some of the financial innovations emerging around solar. Then, it's rock and roll legend, conservationist, and environmental author Chuck Lavelle. He's played keyboards for the Rolling Stones since 1985 and is also known for his work with artists ranging from the Allman Brothers Band to Eric Clapton to the Black Crowes. I talked to him about the ins and outs of his stellar career as a musician, his founding of the Mother Nature Network, and his tireless work for sustainable forestry. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Adam Browning. He's the co-founder and executive director of Vote Solar. It's a nonprofit solar advocacy organization working to bring solar to the mainstream. Adam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, happy to be here. Thank you.
Adam, you're an advocate for expanding solar here in the U.S. In Germany, residential installed solar prices are currently much cheaper. I've read as much as one half. What do you attribute that largely to?
Yeah, so Germany has, you know, instituted a program with their feed-in tariffs where, homeowners, business owners install solar panels on their rooftop and they sell it back to the utility. They don't use it. In California, most of the solar that goes on rooftops, you use yourself behind the meter. So you're not selling it to the utility, you're generating for your own usage. So you're offsetting your retail purchases from the utility instead of selling wholesale power to the utility at a wholesale rate. This is kind of a wonky discussion. It gets a little bit in the weeds. I would just, you know, I'm pointing out that when you talk about Germany's solar costs being half, that's just for the residential installations. And it's important. It's an important distinction, but it's also, it does provide really important lessons for how we can continue to reduce the cost of rooftop solar here in the U.S. So Lawrence Berkeley National Labs has issued a really excellent analysis that looks at the differences between the installed cost for residential solar in the United States and the installed cost for residential solar in Germany. And they find a huge delta. It is approximately, as you say, half the cost in Germany for just the residential solar installations. They go further. They pull out, okay, why is that? Where are the differences? So a good chunk of it is actually in Germany, local municipal, permitting agencies don't require you to get a permit to install a solar system. You just do it. So that actually, you know, here in the U.S., we have places where to do a residential solar installation, you know, it's the same permitting agency that you have to talk to if you want to build an addition onto your house. They'll charge you up to $500 to $1,000 just to get that permit. You know, you may have to go make, you know, three or four trips, send a truck in to get that permit. You don't know exactly what kind of requirements that they have because they haven't made clear exactly. Do you need, what kind of engineering drawings do you need from it? Local jurisdictions can do a lot to reduce the cost of doing business and make your local installed costs of solar much more cheaply. The other big deal in Germany, when you compare it to the installed costs in the U.S., is really the cost of customer acquisition. So SolarCity is a residential and commercial solar installer that just went public, just had their IPO. They revealed that for them, for every customer that they sign up, it costs them a couple thousand dollars to get that customer. We just don't have the same sort of market penetration in the U.S., the same sort of awareness that Germany has been able to build by having all that density as well as the richness of their feed-in tariff. That cost of customer acquisition continues to go down. We've seen some really interesting programs that we're getting involved in as well, where you essentially do group solar purchases. So in Massachusetts, for example, the Massachusetts Energy Office has established these Solarize programs where they go to, they did this with 8 different towns. They got municipal leaders to say, let's do a Groupon for solar energy. And they do a lot of local advertising and they set it up. The more people that get involved, the lower the price goes. And they bid out those jobs to local installers. And the results have been absolutely extraordinary. They've achieved installed costs, I would say 40% discount to average installed costs in the U.S. And it's really just all about scale. It's all about the more people that come together, the lower the prices end up being. And so that's what we're trying to achieve. I think that this is a virtuous cycle where the larger the scale that we get, the lower the prices. And that, that's a lot of what we've learned from the German example. Look, I don't want to minimize the importance here. What happened with Solyndra was a tragedy. When it comes to the nuke industry, it's a way of doing business. I mean, there are ratepayers in Florida that are paying $11 a month for nuke plants that haven't been completed and will never be built.
The average, it's usually 20 to 30 years to build these things traditionally in the U.S. anyway, right?
And they will never exist without U.S. the same type of loan guarantees that went to Solyndra. And there have been, economic failures that dwarf what happened there. So not to say that that wasn't a bad thing, but just to put it into perspective. So, I've been on Fox News. I've talked with some of these news anchors and really do, the things they say are outright lies. And I was actually in a perverse way thrilled when they came out with this latest tidbit because it just showed in a way that you don't actually have to, spend your life working on energy policy to realize that they're just full of it.
There was no wonkishness behind it at all.
There was no, you don't need to be a wonk in order to realize at that point that they're just making it up. They just lie.
Is there any discrepancy between Germany and the U.S. because of the way their home ownership is structured? I don't know what the percentage of rental units they have in Germany, but I know here we have almost a third or around a third of U.S. homes are rental units, and there's been very little aggressive policy to try to address that one-third of American homes to try to get solar into them, as well as from the private sector. They've kind of given up on that. They say, well, that's just a stone that we'll have to turn once we get the two-thirds of American homeowners. Is there any kind of relationship between how the German success story has been?
So, yeah, again, the German model has been not in the past. It hasn't been for generation for your you install a solar system for your own usage. It's been all about selling it to the utility under guaranteed contracts, which have started out at something like 67 cents per kilowatt hour back in 2004, which is really high. They're essentially buying solar power for 67 and then selling it for 21 cents. It was their way of stimulating the industry, and it worked perfectly. Those guaranteed contracts have come down. And so we've gotten to the point where they're now basically on par with retail generation, and it's changing in Germany, where you're now seeing new policies that don't rely on these feed-in tariff contracts. It's about self-consumption. It's about generation for your own usage. But under those guaranteed contracts, you're absolutely right. You don't actually have to own your own house in order for you to have an economic investment. You can sell it to the utility, whether you're a renter or you're not a renter. We've had to be more creative in the United States in order to solve this problem. The bigger question here is, like, how can we expand access to the solar economy? How can we get more people to participate and enjoy the benefits of participating in the solar economy? So we are working here in California and in a couple of other states on shared solar programs where renters, anyone that doesn't own their own roof or is in a shady place, can buy a portion of an offsite solar system and have that credit come to their bill, come directly to them. So it's not necessarily on their own roof, but they're making an investment in a solar system that's sited in a good place for solar collection, and they receive the benefit of it. So
is this almost like a personal carbon offset program?
Sure, but much more actually visceral and tangible. You're not just buying a credit, you're actually buying a piece. There's also, you know, a lot of other interesting things that are happening right now. There's a company in Oakland called Mosaic with the idea of really crowdsourcing solar energy projects. So it allows you to make an investment in somebody else's solar system and receive a rate of return on that investment. If you think about, solar panels are solid state electronics. There's no moving parts. They come with manufacturer's guarantees for 20, 25 years. They're really pretty safe investments. And you should be able to invest in these generating resources and earn a rate of return on par with a bond style rate of return. So what they've done is they've, working with the SEC and the IRS, have established a project by which ordinary investors in California and in New York, they're working on other states, can in the end just, you know, invest in these solar projects and earn something, I think it's about 4.5%, which is better than any bond investment or money market that you'll see right now.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the executive director of Vote Solar, Adam Browning. Adam, we've been focusing on the financing of solar, but can you talk about some of the breakthrough technologies that have you excited? I've been reading about solar shingles, which just look like they're technically just rooftop items in some ways that also produce energy. And there's been some breakthrough in quantum dot technology, solar technology. So what gets you excited about where things are headed on a technology side, on the technology
side? Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. And to be honest with you, what gets me the most excited is that we don't need any new technology. We can get to where we need to go with the technology that we have right now. Increased investment in research and development is always a good thing, but let's not let that be the thing that says, let's wait to do renewables. The plain vanilla stuff that we have right now is sufficient. It generates the same kind of electricity that some magic new solar panel that may or may not happen in the future will generate. There you're just talking about something that would potentially be more energy dense. The technology that we have right now can get us to where we need to go in terms of being effective against climate change. That said, you're right. There are fun new things that are happening. So,
but they're really just affecting the marginal cost and the aesthetics.
It's not just, it's the aesthetics. It's the market. Who are the market players? So let's take, for example, the Dow Chemical Company has a new totally cool product called the Powerhouse. It's the Dow Powerhouse solar shingle. And it's a flexible photovoltaic product that rolls out, looks exactly or almost exactly like your asphalt shingles. And it's installed the same way that you would install your asphalt shingle product. It replaces what otherwise would be ordinary building materials. And it's not that much harder, if at all, to install that product than, again, your normal asphalt shingle. So what does that mean? Well, anyone that didn't want to install solar because of the aesthetics doesn't have that excuse anymore. That's probably not a huge game-changing market. What it does do is that anyone that's getting a new roof, now those roofers have a new product that they can sell. They can say, oh, did hail destroy your roof? Well, we can, you know, we can put in a new roof for you. Would you like a regular roof that will cost you $20,000? Or would you like a roof that will pay you, that will generate your own electricity every day for the next 25, 30 years? Which roof would you rather have? It makes it much easier for that kind of transition, that kind of sale. It gives roofers, which is a huge industry in this country, an easy way to sell a much better product. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm really excited about, say, like the Dow Powerhouse shingle, is that not that it's fundamentally it doesn't generate a different type of electricity. It's not more powerful than anything else, but it solves other problems and it brings new participants into the solar market. And I think really that's what we're looking at. We're looking at new ways of going solar, but we don't need to wait for those. Those things will happen and they'll be cool, but it's not that there's this magic new breakthrough technology that is either going to happen or that we need to wait for it to happen in order for us to have a solution to climate change.
The co-founder and executive director of Vote Solar. People can go to votesolar.org to learn more about it. Adam Browning. Adam, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. I was really glad to be here.
Morning rain keeps on falling. Like the tears that fall from my eyes as I sit in my room staring out at the gloom. It's the rain, it's the same
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chuck Lavelle. He's a musician, an author, and an environmentalist. Chuck, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to be with you, my friend.
Even for those who aren't familiar with your name, Chuck, I'd bet that everyone listening out there in Radioland has heard you play piano. But most of us don't know about your environmental work. How did this part of your life evolve?
Well, my wife and I, her name is Rose Lane Lavelle, by the way. Rose Lane and I have been married, it will be 40 years this year. We were married in 1973.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And when we were young and first dating and we got serious, she said, I want you to come meet my family. Well, I didn't really realize that her family were farmers, but they were. And so they have been connected to the land literally for generations. And when I began to know them better and see the love and the dedication and the passion for the land that they had, Well, it began to rub off on me, and I began to have a better appreciation for land and land usage. And then in 1981, her grandmother passed away, and her father had already passed away. And so she and her brother received an inheritance of some land. Rose Lane inherited about 1,000 acres here in Middle Georgia, Twiggs County, Georgia, which is a little bit below the city of Macon, people may know. And it became at that time our responsibility to carry on what I viewed as a heritage of stewardship of the land. Now, what she inherited was a diversified farm. It had cattle, it had row crops, it did have some timber on it. And I had to give a lot of thought to what to do with this land. Boy, we discussed everything from peaches to pecans to nursery stock to the cattle that was already on the land and various options. But I wanted to pursue my career as a musician, and a lot of those things were just going to be too much day to day. And I began to gravitate towards the idea of long-term sustainable forestry. I guess the first thing that really made me feel connected to that is the fact that that wonderful, marvelous instrument that I play and that has given me so much joy and that has given me my career, the piano, comes from the resource of wood. And so there was an immediate connection thinking about it. And of course, so many other musical instruments come from that resource as well. And then I began to realize and think about all the other things that trees and forests do for us. They give us materials to build our homes, schools, and churches, and offices. And they give us materials to make books and magazines and newspapers and packaging products. And they clean our air, they clean our water, they provide home and shelter to all manner of wildlife. And I just became fascinated with the idea of forest management. And I began to study this. I went to the library, checked out books, and went to other landowners and began to go to meetings and seminars. And eventually, we began to manage our land for long-term forest interest. And that led to some advocacy and eventually to the writing of some of the books that I've had.
And you founded the Mother Nature Network a few years back. People can find it at mnn.com. Why don't you tell us what it is and what's its mission?
I guess the way it started, my partner, a fellow named Joel Babbitt, has had a stellar career in public relations and advertising. And he said, I've been exploring the internet and I can't really find a place that I'm comfortable spending my clients' budget. So what do you think? And, you know, I knew of some of the existing sites out there. There was Tree Hugger, Grist, Planet Green, and, you know, quite frankly, a lot of those were a little maybe narrow in scope, or they were some sites had a political slant. Some sites were organizational. They may be very well-meaning, and but maybe focused on one aspect of the environment. River Keepers, for instance, the Sierra Club, Isaac Walton League, so forth. They're all good sites. They're all well-meaning. They're looking for donations, and they're looking for memberships, etc. So anyway, the bottom line is, Joel said, well, how do you feel about building one? And that kind of shocked me, but I saw the challenge, I saw the opportunity, and he said, Chuck, I will resign my position. He was president and CEO of a very, very large public relations company. And he said, I'll resign my position if you'll go in with me, and I think there's an opportunity. And he said, I think I can get the funding. And lo and behold, and this, by the way, this was in 08 when, you know, the recession was beginning to hit. But lo and behold, within 48 hours, Joel had commitments of up to $10 million for us to build this thing. And we began to hire very talented eco-journalists in the Atlanta area. And so we were able to get some very, very talented writers to join the Mother Nature Network. And we began to build it. We opened offices and we finally launched in January of 09. And you asked what the mission is. The mission is to give people accurate educational information concerning the environment without a political slant. We want to encompass every aspect of the environment, not just focus on one aspect of it. And that has been our mission, and that's what we've been doing. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that the site Tree Hugger, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know about that site, and Planet Green, they were both owned by Discovery. And we recently acquired those sites. And so now Tree Hugger and Planet Green and the Nature Company are all part of the Mother Nature Network. And so we've been growing exponentially, and we're very, very pleased with the success. And our mission continues.
Was your affinity for that natural piano sound, I've noticed just going through all of those, all of the different permutations of bands that you've played with, one of the real signature threads is there's not a lot of synthesizers and effects and things like that, a real natural sound, kind of musicians. Was your affinity for this natural piano sound maybe a preview of your work with trees and the environment, Chuck?
Well, yeah, it's something, shall we say, organic. About playing acoustic instruments, you know, and I'm not exclusively acoustic, but I guess you could use the word vintage. I sometimes use Wurlitzer electric pianos, or maybe even a Fender Rhodes or a Hammond B3, which is a famous organ a lot of rock and roll guys use. There was a point in time when I actually studied up on synthesizers, and I wanted to learn about it. I wanted to understand it. I began to play the instruments and use them occasionally and even to help others better understand them. But, you know, Alex, I just kept gravitating back to the acoustic piano. It's what I love doing. I think it's one of the most amazing pieces of work that mankind has ever come up with. And so I usually stay with the vintage instruments. And I think maybe there is a connection organically to nature and the outdoors and to my interest in forests and forestry.
I also think that your style kind of lends itself to forestry because planting trees is not a quick turnover. This requires a lot of patience and foresight. And your musical style is not show-offy, and it demonstrates a lot of patience and restraint. How do the two worlds converge for you? Do they inform each other?
I was the youngest of three children. And with my father out working, and when I was, say, 5-6 years old, my older brother and sister in school, oftentimes it was just my mother and I in the house. Mom was not a professional or a teacher or anything, but she could play, and she played for family enjoyment. And I would tug on a skirt and ask her to play me something, and she would get me up on the stool and show me simple melodies and chords and things, and sometimes leave me to my own resource. But she would say things to me, and you have to appreciate, you know, she's talking to a six-year-old here. Well, Chuck, what would it sound like if you were mad at your best friend? Or Chuck, what would it sound like if there was a huge storm outside? Or Chuck, what would it sound like if you hit a home run? And so very early on, my mother gave me the idea that music should be about emotions, about colors, about, you know, human interaction, and not just about notes or notes on a page or just notes on an instrument. It's all about feeling and those emotions. So I've tried all my life, whether I'm playing, you know, a piece of rock and roll with the Rolling Stones, or if I'm playing something with John Mayer, or playing something on my own, I try to interpret what that theme of the song might be. For me, it's all about the song. What is the song trying to say lyrically? If there's something I can do musically to enhance or back up or accentuate what the lyrics are, or if it's a lyrical song, if it's just an instrumental, then, you know, what is the theme? For me, it's all been about playing music from the heart, from emotions, from feelings, and, you know, from what the song is trying to do. If the song is called a long solo, fine, you know, play one. If the song is talking about sadness, well, then try to reflect that. So the approach is really for me, to do what the song is asking you to do.
Well, in a couple hundred years, when we're all dead and gone, kids will be playing on the trees that you've planted and taken care of, and they'll definitely be listening to your music. Chuck Lavelle, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Allman Brothers Band, Fleetwood Mac, and Freddie King. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.